Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to a very special and live edition of the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, there is no fixing it in post tonight.
There isn't.
If it happens, it happens.
But the truth is, we've never fixed it in post, Charlie.
I think most of our episodes could be called live, because we have never fixed anything. We've never fixed the air conditioner in the background, or the cat jumping on the table, or knocking over the microphone. Nothing.
Nope. So we're on our own.
All right, and we're also probably going to be talking about the biggest, one of the biggest movies of the entire year, the ultimate blockbuster. 10 years of storytelling, folks, have led to this point. Avengers Infinity War. We're going to talk about if this met the rabid Marvel Studio fans' expectations. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's also a British invasion night. We're going to talk British horror. We're going to talk British rom-com. And I'm sure Bobby Kennedy probably went to Britain once.
That's right. I was like, you're going to have a little bit of a stretch with trying to get Bobby Kennedy in there, but okay.
And we right before we came online, we talked about, are there any British actors in Infinity War? And we came up with four. We came up with Idris Elba, Tom Hiddleston, Paul Bettany, and Benedict Cumberbatch. So we're going to start about right lead off. Avengers Infinity War. Hannah, huge expectations. Already selling out theaters on Fandango long before, months before, when the trailer came out. I think the trailer broke YouTube for a while. 171 million views. Are fans going to be happy?
I think so. It's epic, without a doubt. I'm not sure that the general fan will be as happy as the Comic-Con fan will be. I liked Avengers Infinity War a lot, but I was not in the camp that absolutely loved it, because to me there's so much going on that there's actually too much going on.
There is superhero saturation. Just about all of the Avengers, the Guardians of the Galaxy combine, run into each other, and there's a lot of plot. There are very strong points, which we'll get to. I love the villain. I think the villain, in fact, in my opinion, is the strongest part of the movie. Mm-hmm. And there is an emotional soul between two characters, which, if it wasn't for so much plot, would have gotten a lot more screen time. But they are shunted to the side. But first, the directors, the Russo brothers, Joe and Anthony Russo, came out of nowhere a couple years ago with one of the best Avengers films, in my opinion, so far, Captain America, The Winter Soldier. They came out of nowhere. And then, of course, they were handed the reins of Captain America Civil War, one of your favorites.
Which was, in effect, an Avengers movie, even though it was called Captain America.
And it was really like a primer for Infinity War, because they brought all the Avengers together. And then, you know, what I said was a gimmick, pitted them against each other in these black and white motifs. You either have to be on this side or that side. But I think they pull this off. It's not their fault that they have to include everybody, and everyone has to get their scene, and everyone has to get their line, their one-liner. What brings it all together is the villain, Thanos. We have seen him very briefly in like credit scenes in previous films. He's very, very big. He's very strong. He's also very, very smart. He's stronger than the Hulk. He's smarter than Iron Man. Put that together and you have the universe's ultimate bad guy. One Avenger cannot take on Thanos. He's played computer graphically by Josh Brolin. So it takes a team of not only Avengers, but Guardians. And he has a goal. He has a Malthusian goal, if you know what I mean. He thinks choices need to be made, and he is the guy in the galaxy who's going to make those choices. And he's so evil. But at the same time, I saw a shade of empathy. Mm-hmm. I saw a shade of relatability, even, when he got to talking to say, you know what, I have a side, too. And you hear his line of reasoning. It's like, okay, I see where you're coming from. Your backstory explains your views. Did you see what I see in the villain?
A little bit. And this is what's always distinguished the Avengers, the Marvel Universe, from the DC Comics Universe. This is, in many ways, probably the darkest of the Avengers movie. And yet it still has those elements of heart and sacrifice and humor that have made the Avengers movie so much fun to watch. And so thank goodness they keep some of that, because otherwise this is just one of these movies where for 2 hours and 40 minutes, you are getting pummeled. I mean, this movie is taking place on several different fronts with probably, I think I read like 60 main characters, and it's a lot to track. And so for some people, I think it's going to be too much. But for any Avengers fan who can actually connect some of the dots from previous films, this is going to be a very satisfying movie. The unsatisfying thing is this is not the end. Is that this movie, I'm sorry, it's a cliffhanger. So there's no spoilers here, but this movie definitely, it's not a self-contained, wrap it all up, somebody wins, somebody loses kind of war. It is setting up the next Avengers 4 untitled movie that doesn't come out until May 3rd of 2019. That's a long time to be asking people to just kind of process what they just saw in this movie.
And they're going to need that long to maybe process, because even though we saw it, did I see everything in it? Probably not. I bet I missed a whole bunch of things. Ever since 2008, the first Iron Man, what set the Avengers apart from, you know, Superman and Batman is it's funny. It's mm-hmm. cheeky. It's got that edgy humor to it. And I think about 30-35% of this movie is that. That's always about the level, 70-30. It's really funny. And these guys are trying to figure each other out. Like, one of the older Avengers shows up and says, wait a minute, there's an Ant-Man and a Spider-Man? And and Spider-Man later on says, oh, we're using our made-up names. And it's funny how they poke at themselves. That's what the Avengers, they poke at themselves.
They do, but it's a little bizarre to me. I'm not sure. I'm conflicted on this merging of the Avengers with the Guardians of the Galaxy characters, because Guardians of the Galaxy was always so tongue-in-cheek and was more of a spoofy kind of vibe, whereas the Avengers movies still kind of kept you in this world of, you know, as crazy as it is, you felt this reality to what was going on. And so intermixing the raccoon with Thor, for instance, you know, is...
And they have a moment.
And they have great moments. But, I mean, that's always where the humor comes from. The humor comes from the interaction between all these characters with all of their egos. And so, thankfully, that's still very entertaining. I'll tell you, for a 2-hour and 40-minute movie, this thing moves. It moves at a clip, and so that's pretty, you know, amazing that they're able to pull that off. But whether or not they can pull it off with a second one and have you wait a year and have people not just theorize for the next year as to how they're going to keep the franchise going in so many different ways, I think it's going to be a long year. I'm not quite sure how they can track everything that went on in this movie with all the individual Marvel films that would come out between now and then.
Marvel knows very well we're all going to wait a year. No one's going to give up in the middle. And they're coming so fast now. We just saw Thor Ragnarok, which sets up the beginning of Infinity War. We just saw Black Panther, Wakanda Forever, which is a big location set piece in this film. And just coming down the pike next is Ant-Man versus the Wasp in July, and then next March is Captain Marvel.
And before that, even, we have Deadpool 2 in just a few weeks.
Which does, yes, no.
But, hey, you know, hey, the way they're putting all these things out there, I'm not surprised. I wouldn't be surprised someday if we get the, you know, suddenly it's like, where are the Star Trek people? Because we don't have the fourth Chris in here. We've got Chris Hemsworth. We have...
Chris Evans.
Chris Pratt.
We're missing Chris Pine.
So you're missing Chris Pine. So maybe Star Trek can kind of join in the fun.
No, I really hope they don't do that. There's so much. It's ridiculous talking about this movie. There's so much going on in here. We haven't even talked about the kind of emotional soul of the film, which is Vision and Scarlet Witch.
Mm-hmm.
That in itself could have been the foundation of a film, a standalone film. And they get shoved aside, but they're actually, that's where, if you're going to have feelings in this movie, that's where the feelings come from. We didn't talk about the family problems. The Avengers are always about the family problem. Thor says, well, my sister came back from hell and took my eye. And then Chris Pratt's like, well, my father killed my mother.
Yeah, I was like, I can one-up you on the family dynamics.
There's so much we can't talk about. And I know people don't probably want us to talk about the plot. But, 2 hours and 40 minutes of overload. And it did not feel like 2 hours and 40 minutes. It's a fast, it's like a 2 hour and 19 minutes.
It felt very fast, but I do think it's fair to have people, there's a little bit of research, I would say, that you can still do about the Infinity Stones. Because for me, I did not recall the role of these six different Infinity Stones that apparently over the past 18 Marvel movies have all been introduced in one way.
I remember the blue one from the first Avengers when they brought them all together, the Tesseract. Yeah. I remember the green one
from
Doctor Strange.
But that's just it. Tesseract has a different name. And so if you're not familiar with the fact that they're using different names for these stones, and I didn't realize each one was sort of, you're looking at a stone kind of in its own individually. And so this is really about the bad guy trying to collect all the stones so that he can become the most powerful being in the universe.
All right. Have we beat it to death? Is there anything else? I mean, we didn't even talk about Gamora.
No, I mean, and I mean, how could we have gone through this whole thing and not talked about, you know, Tony Stark?
Iron Man and Doctor Strange.
Iron Man. And the main threat. Absolutely. Yeah. This movie, Doctor Strange, Benedict Cumberbatch's Doctor Strange, has a much larger role than I had expected. And I loved seeing him interact. That was really a fun thing to see him interacting with more with like the Iron Man and the other Avengers. And so I wasn't a huge fan of the Doctor Strange film, but I actually liked him a lot in this movie. And so I like him interacting with these other superheroes. And Thor, to me, is just always fun to watch.
Well, Thor, he gets his almost solo plot line, and I won't tell you what actor he runs into who plays a giant, but that's very amusing.
And
I see what they did there with Iron Man and Doctor Strange. Iron Man, he's a man of science, and Doctor Strange, he's a man of magic, and they're both very self-absorbed and very egotistical. So you put them in the same room, these two alpha males are going to kill each other, really, until they have to work together.
But that kind of goes with almost all of them. Even the women that are sort of fighting alongside of each other, they're like, where'd you come from? And so, yeah, between Wakanda and the U.S. and space, this Infinity War is happening all over the place. And so don't go in there with a big gulp or anything, because you're not going to be able to leave.
Yeah, some people have to get up and leave. They're like, oh, you're in trouble.
No, because you miss 30 seconds of this thing, and you kind of do miss a major beat.
All right. Break. Now for something completely different. British horror. We don't see a lot of British horror. I was trying to think. I was going over my head. What British horror movies have there been? And I could only come up with 28 Days Later. Cillian Murphy, you know, back then in the early 2000s. And this one shouldn't even count, but it does. Shaun of the Dead. More of a comedy than a horror, but it's got zombies in it, so it's got to be a horror movie.
I'm sorry, if you're a Shaun of the Dead fan, that does not make this next film a...
No, they're not the simpatico, but you could say British horror. All right, anyways. All right. Ghost Stories. We're talking about Ghost Stories, straight out of South by Southwest Film Festival. Ghost Stories, it looks like it just stars Martin Freeman, because he's all over the poster and the trailer. But no, he's 33%. Of the film, because Ghost Stories is split up into thirds. And I'm going to give you the overall before I pitch it to you when we talk about the individual segments. I watched it alone and in the dark, and for 33% of the film, I honestly wondered if I could sleep that night. I was terrified. I actually felt dread. And I watch a lot of horror movies. I don't get scared that much anymore. Jump scares still get me because I'm human and, you know, loud noises. But this is 33% of this film is actually true horror. Did you feel the same way?
No.
Oh,
I just wanted it to end.
That's because you watched it wrong. I
fell asleep when in the first 33% of it, I did fall asleep, but then I started over. So I did start over because you seem to indicate that the first story in the three was the best and the strongest and the creepiest.
You cannot disagree with that.
I don't, but to me, I'd rather watch a repeat of The Mentalist, because that's really what this whole thing was about. It's about this professor who has made a career of debunking the psychics, and he's got a show that that sort of pulls back the curtain on, you know, supernatural phenomenon that isn't. And so I just didn't like it. It just, there was just nothing about this film that made it's a Twilight Zone episode. Like,
I can
very
see why you're
long
saying
Twilight
that,
Zone.
I'm shocked that you didn't. I didn't love this movie. I liked this movie because I did for a little bit before it fell apart and the other two segments, which were not that scary. That first one just is so good that it just gets a like from me. Yeah, he's in an old like, I don't know, what would you call it? A torture chamber for women. An asylum where you put the under, you know, the unwed mothers and the babies who didn't survive very long.
It's abandoned, so it's just abandoned.
I don't know why that needs a night watchman.
Exactly, and more than one, because there's another one on the radio there.
And what he experiences that night will just chill you and chill you up your spine.
But that's how I generally know if I'm going to like it, because you liked it. If you loved it, I might have liked it. If you like it, chances are I don't. So that sort of falls into that category of just one of those movies that just doesn't speak to me. It's not my genre. I still want to see, I need to see A Quiet Place, because that one's going to get a sequel now. So I feel like that's the kind of mainstream horror movie that I might enjoy to some degree.
Maybe in Britain this is mainstream.
I don't know, maybe, but I just found it... just not enjoyable. And so it,
you didn't, there's a, I'm not going to give too much away here, but there's an ending that somehow this has to all wrap up, and they wrap it up.
They
and it,
do.
And it's, wow. The ending didn't get you?
Not really. I mean, the ending sort of makes the whole film work. You take that ending away and you've got nothing. And so you've got three Twilight Zone segments.
I emphatically disagree with you. You take the ending away and you have a horror movie built on atmosphere, built on claustrophobia, and it's so British. Look outside. It's miserable.
Exactly.
It's gray. It's wet.
What's not to love about that?
Well, and all right, co-directed by Jeremy Dyson and Andy Nyman. Andy Nyman plays Professor Goodman. So the co-director plays the lead actor. And I love the character actors they bring in. The Night Watchman is Paul Whitehouse. He's actually a very famous British comedy actor. In here, he's playing, you know, scared to death. The middle kid, the guy in the woods, is Alex Lawther. He was he's on that current Netflix show, The End of the Effing World, which I loved. Mm-hmm. And he's also on Black Mirror, if you watch Black Mirror. So he's on The Ascent. And the other one is Martin Freeman.
Yeah.
We know Martin Freeman as Bilbo Baggins, as Dr. Watson, and as the CIA guy from Black Panther. He's actually not as strong as the other character actors,
oddly
enough.
No, but that's why he's the one that you see in the promos, is because that's the one that people will know. And so I think they're kind of leveraging his celebrity a little bit more. Again, it's, you know, I think it's probably very good to people who like that horror genre, psychological drama, psychological thriller. So it is very Twilight Zone-y. So I think if there's, you know, if you really like a really creepy, scary episode of The Twilight Zone, then this is the kind of movie you really should seek out. It does have interesting themes. There's all the subtext about spirituality and religion and one person's reality and how these terrifying events that this guy is investigating, how it impacted these people in the rest of their lives. And he's like so firmly entrenched in being a non-believer, and yet then he's handed these three cases that challenged that for him. So I liked it a little. It's just not one that I would ever really send anyone I know to, unless they were absolutely a fan of the psychological thriller horror genre.
Well, it's interesting to see it as a film. It's based on a stage show. It's based on a play that played for 2 years in the West End. And I wonder if you didn't like it enough because it wasn't so in your face. Most of the horror is restrained. It's shown just off screen, so you don't really see what
I'm not a fan of seeing horror in my face.
And that's how it gets under your skin.
Yeah, no, way. I mean, believe me, I prefer the non-graphical
horror. There are jump scares where, you know, they get you with boo, but it's not the entire film.
Well, I mean, Get Out had shades of that, and so that's what I liked about Get Out, too. And so this one I just think is a very hard sell, and I can see how it worked as a stage play. It probably was very creepy to have the lights down and be immersed with this stuff going on stage. It's just not my cup of tea.
All right, fair enough. I think, I have a guess. I don't know what you think about our next film, but based on that, I think it is more your style. We're talking about another British film, this time a romantic comedy called Modern Life is Rubbish. And we get to know Liam and Natalie. Liam and Natalie have been together for a while. We don't really know, but in years.
Apparently like 10 years.
10 years. They live together, but we come in at a sour patch. Liam and Natalie are breaking up, and there's a gimmick. It's told in flashback, how they meet, how they fall in love, how they fall out, how Natalie falls out of love. And the gimmick is They are dividing their record collection, their CD collection, which, you know, to those of us in our 20s and 30s and some of us, you know, still to today, is a big deal. And so to explain how they met, they do it through records. Even the title, Modern Life is Rubbish, is the second album from the British band Blur. And that has a lot of double meanings in this. And so I'm going to guess, I'm going to go out on a limb here, Hannah, and say you liked to really liked Modern Life is Rubbish.
I did really like it. It reminded me a bit of La La Land. It's like if you took an indie La La Land and you slapped a little bit of the Once vibe on it. So people who watched Once, which was then made into a Broadway musical, but that's like these Irish singers. And then you had, I think it was last year or the year before, this film Sing Street. Do you remember Sing Street?
I love Sing Street.
This reminded me a bit of Sing Street. It reminded me a little bit of that indie Band-Aid.
Sing Street was better.
Sing Street was better than this one. But
Band-Aid,
this is still,
I can't believe you remember Band-Aid.
Yeah. So definitely, I have friends who like were in a band in college, and this movie will speak to all of them.
So when you say La La Land, what I immediately think is Ryan Gosling took heat in La La Land for mansplaining jazz to Emma Stone. Liam, played by Josh Whitehouse, very good actor, singing his own songs here, or at least singing the songs. He meets Natalie in a record store, and he straight up mansplains Blur to her, and then she cuts him off at the knees. Great start.
Mm-hmm.
And then the editing is funny, it's cheeky, it'll get you if you're not used to it. At the end of it, all of a sudden, it's Natalie, you know, taping a box shut, which takes you right out of flashback back into present day. Okay, amusing. That was a good move. This is based on a short film from 2009, which hit the festival circuit really hard, won some awards, and said, all right, you're good enough for 9 years later to make it into a feature film. And it's from director Daniel Jerome Gill. And I'm biased. I'm coming into this biased. I love music. I still buy LPs.
So I have some.
To some people who do that, you will connect with Modern Life. I do not connect with Modern Life is Rubbish as a rom-com, because I can see straight through it.
No, and that's actually one of the issues that I have with how this movie's being touted, because they're calling it a rom-com, but it's not.
What is it?
It's a bittersweet romance drama. It's a romantic drama with some humor in it.
There is not a lot of comedy in it.
It's not comedy. And so when I think of a romantic comedy, I'm thinking more of like a Goldie Hawn kind of movie.
Goldie Hawn movies aren't even funny since like Private Benjamin. Stop it.
Oh, come on. Overboard, which they're redoing.
I'm thinking of Snatched from last year.
Yeah, yeah. Terrible. I'm going back a little bit further. But it's just, I definitely think that this has an appeal. Anybody who's ever been in a Tower Records,
love it.
You know, they're going to.
And there's a moment in the movie where they show Tower Records going out of business. Mm-hmm. And you know what? That did sting. The name Modern Life is Rubbish. Liam, he's kind of a Luddite. He is old school. He's analog, not digital. He does not like technology, iPhones specifically, and that translates into music. He does not like best of albums. They're cheating.
That was,
you know,
funny.
Albums back in the day. Think of Sgt. Pepper's. It was Journey. You listen to it from one, you know, what is Sgt. Pepper's on the greatest hits album? It doesn't work.
Oh, I think
you don't
you were
get
talking
the story.
About a Journey album, because I have all of those.
Well, you know, I'm saying, well, for Journey, I would think I'd rather listen to the greatest hits album. But
I'll lend you my Air Supply greatest hits album. I found that one the other day.
So our executive producer, Joe Bordeaux, who also provided us the wine tonight, the Cabernet Sauvignon from Chile.
Yes, it's
very
excellent.
Good wine.
Thank you.
He sees three movies a year.
Yeah.
And one of them this year in 2018 is Modern Life is Rubbish, a film he never would have seen if he wasn't staying at my house this week. And he loved it. He loved this movie. And I thought he was going to disappear 7 minutes in and I wouldn't see him for the rest of the night.
Well, that says something, that he liked it, that your wife Kate liked it, that I liked it, that you liked it. That means it's got it. There's something obviously that resonates about this film to a lot of different people. It's just one of those really nice small movies, just one of those little gems that's worth kind of seeking out. That has the music. The music is what always saves these movies for me.
It sounds like original tunes that they're playing. The band Head Cleaner is playing,
and
they're not bad.
No, and that's what's really funny too is the whole thing about how they name their band, and you got to put Head in the band, and if you've got Head in the name, then you know you're going to succeed. But here they've been having this relationship for years, and he refuses to get into modern life, and she has to move forward, And she's basically saying, you know, you gotta get to work. Either you need to make your band work so that our relationship can progress.
Get a job, hippie.
Get a job, basically. And so he's very anti-establishment. He's very reluctant. He won't get a cell phone. And so it really is a good way to introduce people to anyone who is resistant. It really tracks. You know, you're kind of going, okay, this dude needs to change at least a little bit. He's dragged a bit kicking and screaming into modern life. But in much the same way, that's why I compared it to La La Land, the same way that the jazz, you know, the guy had to make the jazz a little bit more modern and appeal to a new generation. And he was so resistant. But then once he actually gave it a try, he realized there was some value in that. So there is definitely, it's almost like it's a modern romance with a very throwback nostalgia feel.
So yeah, they're talking about the pros and cons of modernity, and it's not completely pessimistic. You know, even if you are anti-technology, you can go viral maybe, mm-hmm. and maybe people will then see your band. Mm-hmm. Did you notice the point of view? I understand where Natalie's coming from. Get off the couch. I work all day, but we don't see it through her point of view. Our protagonist, our main lens, is actually Liam. We see most of the film through Liam's point of view, and I think it's trying to get us to identify with him more than her.
I don't know. I saw her, too. Her point of view was essentially she was giving up. You see the sacrifice. She's been, for so long, she's essentially been giving up her dream. She wanted to be this graphic artist doing album covers, and then that was an industry that basically went away, and so she needed to shift gears, and she needed to pay the rent, and so she's sacrificing for him. And so once I realized, what she was doing and the sacrifices that she was making, it's like, yeah, I don't blame you, honey. Get out of this. Get out of this while you can. But what I do love about this film, and that's what makes a romantic comedy or romantic drama a selling point for the more mainstream audience, is that this is not one of those films that ends on a really sad, oppressive note. It actually ends in a very nice way.
Maybe that's why you liked it more than I did.
That's right, because it wasn't oppressive and sad and dark. That's right. If it had ended on a really, really, really dark beat, then I'm sure you would have liked it more. But to me, I think that's what makes it something that's just one of those rare ones that is, I think, a little bit more mainstream accessible than so many of these other indies that you make me watch.
All right. Our final discussion tonight is a docu-series. We don't get to review a lot of Netflix stuff. I think the last one we did was Okja, that South Korean film from last year, which ended up on my top 10 list. That's how much I loved Okja.
And technically Mudbound was a Netflix release.
Yes and no.
Yeah. It's a stretch.
Bobby Kennedy for President. Four segments, four episodes, each an hour long. So 4 hours of Bobby Kennedy for President, directed by Don Porter. We're talking rare and never-before-seen archival footage. And, you know, I've seen the familiar shots of Bobby Kennedy, mostly from 1968, when he was running for president, maybe a little bit when his brother Jack was alive and he was this 35-year-old attorney general. And much of this has been digitized for the first time. And I only watched segment one, so that's really all I can review and just guess where this is going. So we're seeing young Bobby Kennedy in the pre-JFK years and during the JFK years, right through the assassination, really, is hour one. And it's a very turbulent time. We're talking civil rights, Cuban Missile Crisis. And what I noticed was, I wasn't alive back then. I did not have conscious thought of the era, but I remember Bobby Kennedy as a man running for president who was the ultimate labor union guy, the ultimate civil rights guy. But actually, in hour one, he's a cop. And he's like buddy-buddy with J. Edgar, and he's eavesdropping on Martin Luther King, and he's not 1968 Bobby Kennedy.
Well, but this, I watched the first hour as well, and I'm like thinking that 4 hours seems a bit steep.
No, I'm in. I think it comes out tomorrow, and I'm in.
I heard that, from what I've heard, the first 3 hours are all pretty powerful and really good, that the fourth is a little weaker. So we'll see, but it really does start at the end. So it sets up the whole journey. No spoilers.
We know what happens.
Yeah, we know what happens at the Ambassador Hotel and that during the presidential run. But I love that they have access to so much archival footage. And, you know, we're so used to seeing so much of Jack Kennedy and Jackie O that it was really nice to see his side of the family, you know, his family and his wife, Ethel, and all of their brood, and how, you know, he really was so influential to what was happening around him. But it also sets up, and I saw little shades of this in the LBJ movie, where you realize, and I don't think it had hit me quite as hard until I was watching it again with this first hour, is just how much LBJ and Bobby Kennedy did not like each
other. LBJ really rarely comes off as a nice guy, and man, does he not come off well here.
Yeah, well, because Bobby didn't like him, and so we're kind of getting Bobby's perspective throughout this.
But Bobby doesn't
film.
Come across that great either. So no. Some of the best interviews are Representative John Lewis. You know, we remember him from the movie Selma. And, mm-hmm. You know, he gets pummeled on the bridge as the leader of SNCC. There's also Harry Belafonte.
A lot of
who
Harry.
I learned a lot from.
Yeah.
Jackie Robinson endorsed Nixon because he didn't believe JFK was as forthright on civil rights as he claimed to be, and apparently he was not. Mm-hmm. Bobby Kennedy also paid lip service to civil rights. Only later did, you know, come around. Harry Belafonte was always a Kennedy man, but Jackie Robinson was not. He's like, hey, I'm going to go for what I think is best, and I don't believe you.
Yeah, I mean, you really see this shift in Kennedy's moral compass and how it became such a big part of the advances in civil rights that, you know, you hope he was doing it for all the right reasons. You're never quite sure whether things were being motivated by politics to some degree, but he still did the right things. And so there's value in that and lessons to be learned in that. And so I am looking forward to the next couple of hours, because it is just something you don't see all the time. You see so much of the JFK angle that it was, it's really intriguing, because you don't, I don't think we really knew all that much about Bobby, unless maybe you saw, remember that TV show?
I saw the Emilio Estevez film called Bobby like a decade ago, which was not very good.
Yeah.
But I could, at some points when they got a mic on him and he's like a tape recorder, I could use some subtitles. It was really hard to hear some of the stuff he was saying.
The Boston accent, too.
Oh, man, that was thick.
The Massachusetts, it's a very thick accent.
How did JFK win that election talking like that?
I know, but it's, I love that it's not really narrated. That
no, there's no one carrying
driven.
You through this.
Yeah,
oh.
And so there isn't, the fact that there's enough raw footage and not your typical talking head interviews, not your academic types, it's really, that I think really helps drive it and make it a little more of an entertaining documentary. And we mentioned earlier, we were talking earlier about how even seeing someone in a photo or in video, like a Dolores Huerta, who was featured in a documentary last year, and I did not know about her at all.
She was on the stage that night.
And yet she was on the stage that night with Bobby Kennedy. And so now I'm looking at something like that, and I'm able to piece together little tidbits from other things that I've seen over the past couple of years, and even little tidbits from the LBJ movie that I don't think anybody saw.
Nobody
that came
saw
out last year or earlier this year.
Jackie.
Yeah, so it's for history buffs, absolutely, and political buffs. This is a really solid documentary to catch on Netflix.
It's solid, but it's honestly not the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
No,
I'm gonna finish it. But it didn't blow my hair back.
It didn't blow my hair back, but I think it could have been. I think I would have preferred knowing that it was only maybe 2 hours, because even with the first hour, I kind of felt like, okay, we know how it's going to end.
But it's not King
Burns. We know
where
this
is
going.
It's not 20 hours of whatever.
No, but thank goodness. I mean, yeah, that's such a different style. So this is not in that style. And that's why this is more in a style of a traditional documentary. And so that's why I don't think it really necessarily deserves 4 hours.
But what may be more attractive to our listeners, instead of fighting the crowds this week at Infinity Wars or tracking down something as niche and small as Ghost Stories and Modern Life is Rubbish, I think tomorrow, Friday, April 27th, you can log on to your Netflix streaming site and watch this.
Yeah, and I think if you enjoy that first hour, chances are you're going to stick it out and continue to watch just because you kind of want to see all the little pieces and where this goes and how they and what other footage they unearth, because it's really cool. It's a throwback to an era that I think people really
miss. He's talking to that guy who goes down to confront Wallace at the University of Alabama, and he puts his kid on the phone.
Yeah.
What are you doing, dude?
That was great. And even just understanding a little bit more about how...
Oh, man, Wallace is already a bad guy, but he comes off so bad.
And, yeah, I mean, the stuff with MLK and how you know that it started out not so great with Bobby's relationship with him, and then you find out that, you know, he made the call to get MLK out of prison at one point, and that kind of changed the dynamic and how he
was
viewed.
Which was politically calculated.
But sure, it was politically calculated, but like I said, it's like, well, at least it was the right thing. So at least when the political calculation is morally right, then I think that's a good thing to reinforce right now.
All right, well, to wrap up the first ever live episode of the Cinema Clash, we couldn't have hit a bigger movie.
That's
Avengers
true.
Infinity War. I believe it's stuffed to the gills.
It is.
I love the villain. I love the ending, which makes me sad about next year.
Yes, it's going to be a very long year, and you have to see it. If you watch other Marvel movies, there's no choice. You're going to go see this one. It doesn't really matter what any of the critics say.
It's like a Star Wars movie.
A Star Wars movie. If you're going to go, you're going to go, and that's how this one is. And I think that if you're not going to go, then that's when you start looking for things like Modern Life is Rubbish.
Ghost Stories. I liked this British horror film where one third of the time I was truly afraid. I just wished the rest of the movie could have caught up with that.
Yeah, I was never truly afraid. I was just truly afraid that I still had to watch another 80 minutes of it after the first act.
That's like three movies a week for you. Modern Life is Rubbish. It's billed as a British rom-com. Mm-hmm. Hannah says it's a romantic drama. I liked it because of the music, therefore I'm biased. Mm-hmm. I like the music part much better than the storyline.
No, I do too. It's the music that always sells me on these, which is why something like a Sing Street is the comparison that I make, and La La Land is was sort of that big mainstream equivalent to this kind of thing, and a Once vibe. And so really, fans of Once will, I think, enjoy Modern Life.
Bobby Kennedy for President, documentary coming out on Netflix. You've never seen these interviews before. You've never seen this footage before. It's all new. It's all digitized. Catch up.
Yeah, everything old is new again.
All right, well, on behalf of the Cinema Clash, thank you very much for spending your Thursday night with us, listening to us live. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.